Today on the 21st Show, the English language has evolved slowly over the course of centuries. But the linguist Adam Alexic says the rise of the social internet, and especially short-form video, is accelerating that effect, teeing up an inflection point on par with the invention of writing or the dawn of mass communication. All this is the subject of his new book, AlgoSpeak: How Social Media is Transforming the Future of Language. I'm Brian Mackey with Adam Alexic for the hour, coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Bloomington Normal, WNIJ in Rockford DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. One constant of history, from the ancient world to modernity, is that our language is constantly evolving. Latin is not a primary language anywhere outside the Vatican, but it begets Spanish, Portuguese, French, and Italian. Likewise, English was influenced by German, and it's clear our manner of communicating has evolved as well. In a few short centuries, we've gone from our "Thinkest thou that duty shall have dread to speak when power to flattery bows?" to "We've had the greatest 6 months of any president in the history of our country, and all the fake news wants to talk about is the Jeffrey Epstein hoax." That was, if you're keeping track, President Trump and William Shakespeare, though not in that order. And the language rolls on. If you have young people in your life, you might have heard them use words such as skibbity or riz or sigma. Maybe that's mumbo-jumbo to you, kind of like the word mumbo-jumbo was to someone else in the past. But my guest today says that's just how language evolves. And as we continue through the internet age, more specifically the era of short-form video, the rate of change in our language is only going to accelerate. Adam Alexic's new book is AlgoSpeak: How Social Media is Transforming the Future of Language. You might already know him online as @etymologynerd, where he posts about linguistics.
You know how ChatGPT will overuse certain words like delve, commendable, and meticulous? Well, now we have proof that that's starting to affect our real language. A new study just came out where they analyzed over 700,000 spontaneous spoken conversations, and what they found is that the overused AI words also started significantly being overused in our actual speech shortly after ChatGPT came out. We're simply saying delve at higher rates than before, especially when compared to control words like examine or explore, which weren't overrepresented, and you can see those stay the same in our vocabulary. And on one level, this sort of makes sense. Humans are imitative learners, and we mimic the speech we see, so of course we're gonna start talking more like AI if that's what we're looking at. But on a much stranger level, this is actively bringing ChatGPT's biased representation of language closer to reality.
Adam joined us for the hour in a conversation we first aired over the summer. That means no calls during our program today, but we did ask our texting group about this. Tony in Champaign said, "I don't mind new words at all, as long as something like the Urban Dictionary can translate for me." We also heard from Lloyd in Danville, who said, "While words come and go with new social changes, I prefer preserving the English language. As an African American, the phrase right on had multiple meanings. As Dave Chappelle says, word, it has too many applications." All right, here now is our conversation on the internet and how it's influencing our language. All right, Adam, let's start with kind of an icebreaker, if you will. You know, everybody has things about language that sort of grate on them, even people who accept change or even embrace change. Are there any words that you know sort of have grown to hate, or that set your teeth to grinding?
Well, of course, everybody makes their individual choices about how to use language, and that includes linguists themselves. We're trained in linguistics to like not make any judgment calls on language, but then we also have to use language. So the more I look into words, the more I see, oh, you know, this word came from this originally had like a racist origin or something. Maybe I don't want to use that one. And that's the only conscious decision usually I make. And that's still a subjective, you know, because sometimes these words just lose meaning. And is it really bad to use them anymore? It comes down to individual judgment calls about how you should be using language.
Yeah, for me, it's cliche that really gets me going. Like I hope listeners will never hear me use the word impact unless I'm talking about a vehicle crash or molars.
Well, but here's one, the ChatGPT stuff. Like, I try to talk less, like, so I'm avoiding the word delve so it doesn't sound like I'm using AI.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah. Well, we can get into how AI is gonna upend all this as well. But all right, let's start where your book does, which is with this word unalive. I got to admit, it's new to me, or it was new to me when I read about it in the book. Can you explain what that means for others who may be unfamiliar?
Yeah, it's a synonym of kill or commit suicide that was popularized because you can't really say kill on TikTok. They'll suppress your videos. So this word started out in a 2013 Spider-Man meme that got remixed in a 2018 Roblox meme and then found a genuine place in this mental health community on TikTok where they needed a way to spread their stories and share resources. But it also became a part of the AlgoSpeak sociolect, AlgoSpeak being speech used to evade algorithmic censorship, and sociolect being this social group that speaks a certain way. So we have this online community using the word unalive to mean kill, and then it starts bleeding offline. And my book opens with the example of the Seattle Museum of Pop Culture last year, where they, for the 30th anniversary of Kurt Cobain's suicide, they didn't say that Kurt Cobain killed himself or committed suicide. They said that he unalived himself at 27. And you'll see kids in like middle schools writing essays on Hamlet's contemplation of unaliving himself, if we're getting into Shakespeare. But this is a real internet word bleeding into real life. And more than that, it's an example of algorithms literally shaping how we speak. But I start with that example because I think it's the most surface level example we can point to of, say, clearly saying, aha, algorithms are shaping our speech. In fact, it's much more than that as well.
What is it? What is that word? Like, break it down for us grammatically, right? Unalive. Is it even like, I don't know, quote unquote, correct? Do you even accept that?
Well, it's correct in that it's used in a functional way that is, it's reproduced in this meaning. Alive, you know, is alive, and unalive, it does make sense. People say it sounds like maybe Orwellian or like 1984 speak, but in fact, we've been euphemizing language forever. What it's doing is it's a euphemism, and the way the kids are using it when they say, oh, you know, Hamlet thought about unaliving himself, it's because they're afraid of saying the word suicide, which sounds like a scary word, admittedly, and so they turn to this more cheerful sounding word for a serious concept, which, you know, that has its own, like, judgment value, whether you think it's trivializing language or whether it makes it easier for these kids to have this discussion. But the fact is, we've been euphemizing language forever. That's why we say things like kick the bucket, which also sounds a little goofy.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. One thing I hear in it is it removes the agency, right? Because technically some of the death we're talking about in this case is de-aliving, right? Not necessarily unaliving. Or maybe,
well,
I'm making a distinction
without
a difference.
Reflexive. So you could say he unalived himself. And I think there is... Maybe it does remove agency. I don't know. It's your call again. I just like to tell people where these words come from, and maybe you can make your own decisions. But it's good to be aware of where they are coming from, and that is the algorithm right now.
Yeah, and like you said, we have no shortage of euphemisms for death. As journalists, we are trained to say someone died, right? So that there's no confusion among our listeners when we would say someone passed or is not with us anymore. Like, you should not hear that in a news report. But like you say, there's a long history
it's
of coming up
with. Too,
yeah.
Right? So what works in the journalism context works differently in the TikTok context. In the same way, I'm not using my TikTok voice right now because there's a different voice that works for this context, and I'm probably still talking too fast.
That's all right. It's going to keep our listeners awake. Talk a little more, because I was really interested in that. Like you mentioned that. So this is it's made to evolve, or to evade algorithms, right? Or the word rises because of that. But it really does create openings for mental health discussions among young people, you found.
Well, otherwise that discussion wouldn't be able to be had online at all. But yes, offline, in some cases, kids are learning this word before the word suicide itself. They learn it from friends, they learn it from people online, they don't realize the context, and then they reproduce it. And in fact, it does help them talk about this, because if they do know the word suicide, it could be a very kind of, a word you don't want to use. It sounds intimidating.
All right, maybe we can talk about the origins of some of the other, you know, words that are popular among Generation Alpha, such as Skibbity or Riz or Ohio, not the state, I gather.
Ohio and Skibbity are just nonsense words that they say because it sounds funny. And honestly, these trends are also sort of dying out. There's always new words coming about. And it's more about what the algorithm is doing and how is it bringing these words to us. So Ohio and Skibbity, they really don't mean anything. They're just funny things that people say. Riz is romantic charisma. And these are all quote unquote brain rot words. They're classified as part of this meme aesthetic of words that are supposed to rot your brain. And I should say also that neurologically, that's never true. There's never anything worse about one word than another word. but we have this perception, you know, that they belong to this kind of comedic genre of funny sounding words, and we repeat them. And it's directly because of the algorithm. Once a word like Riz or Skibbity starts trending, creators then hop onto that trend for a chance to go viral, because algorithms push human trends. We naturally, as humans, we experience fads and memes and trends. This has always been a thing. But algorithms compound that because they try to pay attention to what is trending in human populations. They push that, and then creators know that if they hop onto the algorithmic trend, the algorithm will push their videos more. So we replicate these words. I've made videos on the etymology of Riz and Skibbity that have gotten millions of views because I knew that they would, because the algorithm pushes these videos. But as I make those videos and as other creators make these videos, we perform those words more into existence. And now they become more of a trend. And then the algorithm pushes them more. And we end up in this positive feedback loop of words hitting the mainstream much, much faster than they otherwise would.
Yeah, well, and this is where you come to, I mean, the entire book is called AlgoSpeak because the influence of algorithms is what you identify as this key factor. Maybe before we delve more into that, we can talk through some of the other historic delve. There you go. I had ChatGPT write this whole thing. Kidding. Do not have ChatGPT write my questions. But before you, before we get into that, we can dive into some of the other historic inflection points that you say revolutionized language. What are some of those?
Absolutely. Language is a story told through the tools we use to communicate. And this starts out before we have any writing, we had to tell stories still. We relied more on oral tradition. We would have rhyming and meter as the underlying infrastructure of how we remembered our stories. Then we were allowed to write things down in more persistent mediums, stone, tablet, and then we moved to paper. And now, it's okay to add spaces between words because we're not as constrained on space. But now it's okay to like make chapters and segment our stories differently. And then we moved to the printing press, which mass democratizes in one way who can write things. There's more written vernacular in other languages than Latin, but at the same time, there's more gatekeeping and more institutionalized forces governing language. And the way we tell stories, again, shifts. Then we move to the internet. The internet allows for the written replication of informal speech. You have text slang. You have people, nobody's regulating as much. And so we have all these new words come because of the internet. And now I think algorithms are another inflection point because they're a new infrastructure for how we're communicating, and that infrastructure is going to subtly shape our communication.
And talk a little more about how that works, right? I mean, is it that these algorithms are actually detecting the use of the words? I mean, we're well beyond having to load up hashtags, right? Although people still do.
Yes, hashtags are, functionally irrelevant because these algorithms analyze every single word that's spoken and appears on screen when you upload the video. So in the past, hashtags serve the function of metadata, information about the content. Now every single word is also information about the content. Every single word you say influences the algorithm. So that means that we will say things because we want the algorithm to recommend our videos. And there's a few things that the algorithm will incentivize, right? It will incentivize using platform-friendly speech like unalive instead of kill. It'll incentivize pushing memes and trends like I talked about with Riz and Skibbity. It'll create in-groups and echo chambers. And again, humans naturally sort themselves into groups. This is a thing that we do. But algorithms push us into echo chambers, which has been well talked about. And inside these echo chambers, they're now incubators for new language formation. We now have all these people with shared interests and shared identities with the shared need to invent new slang. So they do. But the algorithms open up those echo chambers just enough to allow those words to spread across as broad trends. We have algorithms incentivizing attention-grabbing language because let's not forget that the function of social media, what these platforms are doing, is they are commodifying your attention so that they can sell you more ads and sell your data. That's what they're doing. They bake in those attention incentives into the structure of how videos get recommended. They push metrics like retention, which is how long people watch your video. They push likes and comments and shares. And so now me, as an influencer, and other creators, we all have to adhere to that. We have to find ways to get attention. So I think language is also evolving around what grabs our attention, which in some case, it's always been true, right? But it's now compounded, and algorithms are pushing these trends faster and emergently creating more language than otherwise would exist.
You have to be a consumer to create the content for these algorithms, I take it?
Well, they operate under techno-feudalist logic where the users
down for us. Yeah.
Yeah. Techno-feudalism is sort of this idea of how algorithms and platforms structure reality. the users are the product, the users consume the product, and the users make the product. So I, as a creator, I upload something, then somebody else watches it, and that's their entire model. Like, they just create the infrastructure for that interaction to take place. But in the meantime, they can reap the benefits of our data and our attention. And so basically, we are like serfs toiling away at a feudal land. That's a very important background to understand if you're trying to not only understand social media, but then understand how we communicate, that it all descends down from what these platforms want us to be talking about.
Is your best understanding that it's primarily about the money, or is a factor, there's other factors.
Oh, there's different levels at play, right? The platforms care about money. Now, humans, we care about communicating and being funny and spreading ideas. And we are, in fact, incredibly tenacious at doing that. I'm not trying to paint this like the algorithms have the final say in what we do say. In fact, the word unalive is a testament to how humans always come up with new ways to express themselves. The word unalive is actually now also censored. People have turned to other phrases. You can say you Kermit sewer slide, or you can spell unalive with an at sign or an exclamation point instead of an A or an I. There are always new ways of coming up with methods to express ourselves. And there's always like humans trying to communicate their stories. We always communicate those stories through the media that are available to us. And in this case, that's the algorithm. So it's a story told in multiple parts, what the platforms are doing and what the people are doing.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation after a short break. We're listening back to our interview with Adam Alexic, author of AlgoSpeak, How Social Media is Transforming the Future of Language. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
Exactly what I mean. It starts out like an A word, as anyone can see. But somewhere in the middle, it gets awful queer to me. Abkadefki Jekyllman, not for Stuwixes. If I ever find out just what this word can mean, I'll be the smartest bird the world has ever seen. What can that strange-looking word possibly mean? Funny word. It might be kind of an elephant, or a funny kind of kazoo, or a strange exotic turtle you'll never see in a zoo, or maybe a kind of a doggy, or a particular shade of blue, or maybe a pretty flower. Nah.
It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're listening back to our conversation on the evolution of language and how the modern internet is changing the way we speak at an ever-increasing pace. This is why you hear young people using words like riz or skibbity, and also the reason why words like cool are not seen as slang anymore, at least not by most of us. It's all covered in the book AlgoSpeak, How Social Media is Transforming the Future of Language, by our guest, Adam Alexic, who goes by the Etymology Nerd online. Since our program's on tape, we originally brought this to you in the summer. No live calls during the hour today, but we did hear from several of you by text when this first aired. Karen in Urbana said, ain't is a word that used to have its own associated rhyme. Ain't a word, ain't in the dictionary, and I ain't gonna use it. Spoiler, it is in the dictionary now. We also heard from Betsy in Rockford, who said, I never thought awesome would survive, but here we are. Things are awesome. We also got this voicemail.
Good morning. This is Tana from rural Menard County. I hadn't thought about language evolving faster because of the internet. I can't, intelligently that is, go back to my Wii U Tech, aka WIU linguistics course back in the 1960s, but for me, I love genealogy, and genealogy is just the study of grandma's stories, of grandpa's stories and words going back a long way. So the study of words we use is just like the study of history, which is just like the study of people's stories from the times past, which is just like, don't tell the kids this, but there is one word from my youth, I will be old next year, 80, that goes back at least 100 years to the 1920s and its meaning of good or great. When was the last time you said cool? That word is ubiquitous everywhere and apparently here to stay. These examples you gave and many others, I hope, not so much.
Adam Alexic, talk about words with staying power, like cool, and how, what's happening today may or may not follow that precedent.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a lovely analogy to genealogy. I've always felt that etymology is sort of the genealogy of language and history, and all this is very tied in. Where ideas come from in the past, how they get remixed and readopted. This is sort of what we're talking about when we're also talking about how words stay, how trends and fads stick around, versus like you look at, you know, evolution, some like families might die out, some family lines might end. In the same way, some words might end, the fad ends. What happened with the word cool? I actually opened my sixth chapter with the word cool and the story there, because this starts in 1880s in African American English, and it comes under resistance, also associated with cool temperatures. And that's the original idea, that it's a feeling of resistance, of subcultural kind of awareness of oppression. In the 1930s, we see Miles Davis and the general emergence of like cool blues. So we have like Birth of the Cool, Charlie Parker's cool blues, and cool jazz becomes an aesthetic, and it becomes cool to be cool. And the word cool literally spreads because it is cool. And you see these subcultural groups like the beatniks and the hipsters start talking about things being cool, and the word continues spreading. And then all of a sudden, cool is associated with fashion aesthetics of like wearing cool sunglasses, and the word is taken away from that original meaning of what it is to be cool. But it found a place because it describes literally this subcultural feeling of aura that people like, and the word cool spread along that. And you see time and time again that words spread along the conduits of what is seen as funny or what is seen as cool. This is also happening online today. A lot of words are coming again from African-American English because it's seen as either cool or funny. A lot of words are coming from the manosphere, which can be both cool and funny. Now, to address like what makes a word stick or what makes a word die out, it's a really complicated answer. There's a lot of stuff going on. One is whether it fits a need in the language. We call that a lexical gap. If there's a, like, we needed a word for this concept. So, for example, in 2013, the word selfie emerged, and that really fit the concept of we needed something to talk about how we take photos facing ourselves. Around the same time, the word yeet emerged in Gen Z slang. And people don't really say yeet anymore. If they do, it's ironic. So yeet didn't stick around because it didn't have much of a need to stick around. At the same time, it was tied to the lifespan of a meme. When the meme dies out, the word dies out. If your grandmother starts saying yeet, if your grandmother starts saying skibbity, you stop saying these words because it's not cool. And it's cool because it's in the in-group of people in the know, right? And that's another thing. How much does a word stick out? If a word sticks out as an obvious example of a meme, it probably will not be around to last, because then it dies out with that meme. Selfie was never thought of as a meme, although it still has a lifespan like any other word. Maybe hundreds of years from now, we'll evolve past the word selfie. But it stuck around because it wasn't seen as a meme, and because it was easily readaptable, and because it filled a need in our language. So that's sort of a long-winded explanation, but that's how words sort of stick around.
No, I like that. I wonder if you can you use that sort of algorithmically, to borrow a phrase, as, you know, this idea that selfie was there to meet, it met a need for a word that we didn't really have, to sort of, is there a predictive power in that when you're considering, you know, these slang words that are coming up today? How many of them, you know, if you had to roughly put a percentage on it, are truly rising up because, you know, there's some need, unmet need, I should say.
It'd be impossible to put a percentage on this because linguists don't even have a definition of what a word is. It sounds funny to say, but we can't actually agree on that. We can't agree on what's a slang word, what's a regular word, how long a word is actually staying. It all gets incredibly subjective and hard to quantify here. It definitely is true that algorithms are pushing more memes than before, and we are very aware of the meme words, right? There's a lot of words that are more low-key, such as the adverb low-key, which was trending for a while. It really began emerging in the 80s, but didn't really get popular until now in Gen Z slang, but originally described this sort of muted aesthetic. And now you can say, oh, that's low-key really cool. And I'm modifying, like, is there when I say that. It's a new use of the word, but people don't think of that as a slang word. And that's going to stick around because it kind of subtly wormed its way into our language and filled not an obvious need, but it nevertheless satisfied like the people who are using this word. in a way that they didn't see it sticking out, I think that word is going to stick. And there's a lot of other small phrases under the radar, side eye, function as a synonym for a frat party. All these things are kind of new emergences, but we don't think of it as quote unquote brain rot. I think the brain rot words like the Riz and Skibbity are not going to stick around because they stick out far too much. We're too aware of them and they're going to die out with the word's lifespan.
Do you think that, I mean, does this mean that slang has, because of this rapid pace, is it less likely to stick around than it might have in the past where things had to build a little more slowly?
It really depends on where we're drawing that boundary of slang. Some of it, absolutely. Like, these words come and go so quickly because algorithms are pushing them, and they push the trend faster even once the word is popularized, and now your grandmother is going to be saying skibbity a lot faster than she otherwise would. So that means the word skibbity is going to have a two-year lifespan or something. They are pushing the words faster, which could cause them to both emerge and die out faster. However, at the same time, there is also all these under-the-radar words, like low-key, that it's hard to even quantify how much words are changing. Sometimes it's just a shift in definition, a shift in vibe. All this, like, still is being affected by algorithms.
Let's go down to the phones. Craig is calling from Northern Illinois. Craig, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm curious, you know, I've often recommended that the book Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Hollywood, where he refers to the fact that every technology creates its own epistemology. And so this gentleman is working with a technology that creates a kind of worldview that's based on algorithmic computations. But language goes far deeper than just basically waking state or technological concepts. For example, the language of Sanskrit, which is one of the most ancient languages for the Indo-European language, it literally is conceived from a field of consciousness transcendent to the waking state of awareness. And with all this technology, what I find is that it loses its depth, it loses its connection to the infinite because it's based on very finite algorithmic numbers. And since I've been doing lots of transcriptions of my relatives in the 19th century, language has a capacity to, of course, evolve and change. But with this new social media language, I'm wondering who they're going to connect with 200 or 300 or 400 years from now. Will there be any historical, cultural connection to the prior periods, the prior eras of human evolution and development?
Craig, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. Adam, I'll let you take that on.
Craig, I love the amusing ourselves to death reference, and there's definitely something there that each medium distills an infinite amount of possibilities of what language could be into maybe a finite box. The same is true of other mediums in the past. If you're writing in, I just wrote a book. I had to adhere to formal English, which actually constrained my expression. When I had to talk about the adverb low key in my book, they made me put a hyphen in it, even though that's not how the, you know, the word is usually used in slang discourse. So each platform and each medium is uniquely going to constrain how we speak. We're not just speaking on social media. We're also speaking off of social media, and each medium still has immense power. I think social media right now, algorithms and platforms like TikTok particularly, are where ideas seem to be emanating out of in our culture. And we are getting more of our discourse coming from there because, or at least like once it's brought up to TikTok, there's an effervescent ability to surface new trends and to push these trends that these platforms are doing. And so these are still the conduits of where our culture is being influenced from. At the same time, it bleeds offline. And then it bleeds into other media. And each medium, again, has this unique method of expression. So it's definitely important to remember that, yeah, language reflexively evolves around the tools that we use to communicate with. But at the end of the day, how much are future generations going to connect with this? There's this quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson that I always really like, that language is fossil poetry. And that what that means is that every single generation contributes a new layer of these fossils of like words that were compelling to them, and then they get stacked on top of each other. I don't think that process is going to end. Language is the history of us using different media, and we started out talking about tablets, and we talked about oral tradition and all these different forms of media, and the internet and television and radio, these also influenced language. And each of these forms of media does affect the kind of course of where words are coming from and how they're changing. But at the end of the day, we're still just adding new little fossils of poetry, which I think is pretty beautiful. And there will be something in this generation for future generations to look back at and say, oh, that etymology, that genealogy traces back to the TikTok era.
You know, I've been transcribing some of my own grandfather's World War II letters. Are the, you know, future grandchildren of today's high school students going to be going back and, you know, doing mashups of their grandparents' TikToks? Or, I mean, does the, you know, how does the ephemerality, you know, affect this idea?
Oh, this is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's more persistent mediums. And I think it's absolutely true that these platforms are not going to last forever. For example, we saw Vine, the video app platform, die out. It's a lot of Vines were lost. And that's something about the internet, that it does feel less permanent in the real world. You know, I always try to back up my stuff on hard drives, because you never know. You never know when things are going to be deleted, when you're just going to lose access. And constantly information is being lost online. So this is definitely something to think about. Maybe we'll be able to play TikTok montages at funerals, but I somehow don't think so. I think it'll still be like the photos and the videos we can pull together, and some of that might be TikTok, but it's what is persistent, the mediums that continue carrying ideas. Nevertheless, the words that we're using is now crystallized into language itself. So that's not stuck on the TikTok medium. The fact that these middle schoolers are saying unalive and riz, that's actually in our offline infinite expansive language.
So I guess maybe the object lesson here is, or the practical news you can use is, like, set that you know, inheritor for your iCloud account, right? There's Apple has that setting where you can go in and say, you know, in case I die, in case I'm unalived, someone can access my account. Couple minutes until we need to take a break. I want to come back to this idea of censorship you talked about, and specifically, you know, some of these words that, you know, like, okay, one is retarded, right? This is once a mainstream term to describe people with developmental disabilities. And, you know, it was once an improvement on moron and imbecile, which are earlier words that we used for people with those disabilities. But now it's so derogatory where some people only refer to it as the R word. Yet here's Elon Musk trying to pull it back into common usage. Talk about what's going on there.
Steven Pinker terms this the euphemism treadmill, the idea that words become pejorated or take on a negative meaning, and then we need to find a new word to use the same function. So the fact that idiot, imbecile, and moron were genuine scientific classifications of intelligence in the early 1900s, but then got turned into insults, meant that we had to come up with the word retarded. Then that became an insult. And then we turned to other phrases like mentally challenged or something like that. And these also took on their own negative coloration. That's always been a process. And again, this is something from the early 1900s. And there's always people in varying stages of reacting to that, thinking, oh, we should be using this word, we shouldn't be using this word. The fact of the matter is that words change vibes over time. What we do get is, I think, algorithms amplify this sort of euphemism treadmill through literally what we can see with unalive and other examples. I really like the example of China. So in China, the word for censorship is censored. And people are very aware of this. They instead turn to use the word harmony, which sounds something like hoshu, and that started being censored. Harmony was an allusion to the Chinese government's goal of creating a harmonious society. So it was sort of a play there. But once the word for harmony also started being censored, because the word for censor was first censored, users then moved to the word for river crab, which sounds similar to the word for harmony, hoshu. And that kind of also started being censored, so people turned to the phrase aquatic product. And what you see is it's kind of a game of whack-a-mole, right? The mallet comes down, this new word starts being censored, and a new mole pops up, new form of human expression. And if anything, humans are constantly one step ahead of the algorithm. We're aware of what it's doing, and the word itself is a metalinguistic recognized like symbol that we know that this is happening. But at the same time, we find ways to express ourselves, because that is a tenacious, yeah, creative human impulse, that we find ways to talk about what we want to talk about.
All right, we have to take another break on the program. More to come with Adam Alexic. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
If you can't write in the proper way, if you don't know how to conjugate,
maybe you flunked that class, and maybe now you find that people mock you online.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to our conversation with Adam Alexic, the author of AlgoSpeak, How Social Media is Transforming the Future of Language. You can also find him on social media at Etymology Nerd. Since our program's on tape today, we're not taking calls, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address, talk@21stshow.org. All right, so as a content creator, right, what do you think of algorithms? How have they changed your approach?
Well, exactly. As a linguist and as a content creator, I can't not think about this. I'm always noticing my language and how I'm rerouting my speech around these algorithms. And my research started with words like unalive, but I soon began to notice a lot of other things. Inflection patterns, like the influencer accent. At the start of this segment, you played a clip of how I talk online, which hopefully sounds different than how I talk in person. I'll talk more quickly, I'll stress more words to keep you watching my video. And all of that is because I'm trying to get people's attention because I want the algorithm to push my content. And you'll see different forms of influencer accents emerge. There's a lifestyle influencer accent like, hey guys, welcome to the 21st show, sort of that uptalk characteristic of like Valley Girl English, but it's actually very good for retention because it makes it sound like something's always coming next and it fills dead air, which is really bad for algorithms. So these accents emerge because they are good at grabbing attention. And then they replicate online and people start subconsciously speaking in that simply because that's the accepted way to speak online now. And so that's just one example, right? You see grammatical changes, dialectal changes, all these memes and trends and in-group language also emerge because of algorithms.
And we're even seeing this loss of accents and the emergence of online-specific accents that you just alluded to. Say more about that.
So, I mean, we've had regional accents dying out before the internet. So it's always a product of globalization. The Texan accent, for example, there's a study that came out in the last 20 years declined at 60%. We have all these regional accents in England dying out, the Southern accents kind of on its way out. You know, there's a few strongholds, but it's been a thing that we're homogenizing the American accent as we globalize and we're sort of trending towards similar speech. At the same time, I feel like some of that speech is being replaced with online speech because this is also now a place in which we communicate with one another. And there's all these in-group dialects that develop around different fandoms. Like Taylor Swift fans will speak completely differently online in the Swiftie community. And K-pop fans will talk differently. And the Manosphere will talk differently. And then there's also these like verbal accents that are different between influencers. So you see almost the replacement of offline variation in linguistics with online variation.
What insights would you have for like news media, right? Well, maybe we can turn this into a bit of a struggle sesh for us here. Right? Exaggerated titles, fast-paced videos. This is what drives attention in modern social media. Like, talk about the disconnect between that and, you know, what I do, what I was trained to do when I was, you know, cutting my teeth as a news broadcaster.
Well, what you're doing right now is you have a radio accent, right? This is like in NPR, they make fun of like the NPR accent. On broadcast TV, this just in, people talk differently on air than they do with their families because there's a certain expected way to present through this medium. Influencers are just doing the same thing in a new medium. However, there are differences, of course. The sensationalism of the internet is absolutely something that maybe is amplified online. Unfortunately, I do think I see this bleeding into our real kind of media. Real is, you know, also fake, but media in other contexts. So the New York Times, for example, A/B tests all their headlines and they just go with the one that gets more clicks. That doesn't feel like neutral objective reporting to me. That feels like yellow journalism and sensationalism. But that's something that they have to do to compete with the social media landscape where things are battling for your attention online. So unfortunately, we have more of a trend towards things that are really like in your face meant to grab your attention.
Couple of other points from your book I want to be sure we get to. One of those is that, you know, we talked a little about cool and the history of that, but a lot of new words come from African American English. Talk about that lineage.
Right. So we talked about how words follow the conduits of what is seen as cool or funny. Unfortunately, African-American English was created as a way to differentiate among Black Americans, to differentiate their speech from the white norms of the English language, because people do point to these like Oxford dictionaries as like the basis for what the English language is. But that doesn't really represent a lot of people. So they come up with language, especially in like, let's say, the ballroom scene in the 1980s. You'll have modern day slang words like slay, serve, eight, bet, yas. All of these like are modern slang words, and yet they all come from that queer Black Latino space in New York City in the 1980s. And that happened because the space really had a kind of a shared effervescent cultural moment where they were coming up with new ways to build their identity and share that with each other. And then it was also seen as cool. It was also just this socially desirable thing among the liberal counterculture to start speaking more like ballroom slang. And it starts with, you know, Black and Latino gay people, but then it moves to white gay people. And then it moves to the straight white friends who are girls of gay men. So that's how these like words move across filter bubbles. That's a natural thing that eventually, just like the word cool, words change context. But the word cool took maybe 50 years to even start hitting the mainstream. Ballroom slang got there a lot faster. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, you know, it's in some at some point people are a fan of these cultures and you know they like the word, so they're doing that, and then somebody pulls out like, well, you're appropriating this culture. How do you think about that line? And I mean, is that a new trend as well?
No, I mean, the word cool was appropriated, and in linguistics I want to say the word appropriation just means taking from one context and using it in another. That's all it is. It sort of does have all these social implications outside of linguistics because of kind of the social implications that follow there. Like, what does it mean that you're using it in a different context? Like, are you removing power from that original community in which it was used? I mean, probably. Again, I'm not here to tell you what to say. I'm here to show what's happening, and you can make your own calls whether you think this is a good thing or a bad thing to incorporate into your vocabulary. At least once we are more aware of where words are coming from, we can be more conscientious in our language use. But appropriation is this literal linguistic process of words changing between social groups. That's always been happening.
And I guess when I said, is it new, I guess I meant the idea of like pointing fingers and saying, you know, like I hung out with a bunch of musicians when I was in college in the 90s. Some of them were in the jazz studies program, and they would start using words like cat and copacetic as though they were, you know, in the 50s Greenwich scene or whatever. And, you know, I think nowadays people might say, ooh, that's cringe to do that or worse, right? Yeah, I guess that's what I was asking.
Is more of that woke attitude, I guess, that doesn't like language moving across these bubbles, and maybe more of a word policing than there used to be. But at the same time, there is still like regulatory functions in-group language. Like if you tried to say the word slay to a ballroom queen in New York City in the 1980s, they would probably look at you funny.
Yeah, that's
right.
But
it's just that there's no regulatory mechanism online.
Talk about the emergence of core words, right? What is core?
Yeah, well, core is a suffix that really emerged in 2021, 2022. It was circulating on Tumblr before, but as we see, algorithms popularize trends from previous platforms and previous memes in new ways. And so core describes a lifestyle. You could append it to anything: cottage core, goblin core, angel core. These are not only like fashion aesthetics, but they're marketed as entire lifestyles. And there's cottagecore clothing and cottagecore music and cottagecore decorations for your home. And what these are is they're more than, you know, simple labels. Once a label is out there, you either identify with it or against it. And the algorithms like attaching labels because now they have more ways to categorize you. They have more ways to recommend you more content, more ways to target you as a consumer. And I examine in the book, AlgoSpeak, how they push these cores because they are good for that purpose. Like they're not even trying to hide it. Like the TikTok, the business page literally claims that subcultures are the new demographics and gives businesses ideas for how to profit off of cottagecore. And that word demographic is interesting because a demographic in the past is like race, age, gender. Now it's also whether you're cottagecore or not. So core to me is this signal of the increasing kind of commercialization of our labels and how algorithms are pushing identities as manufacturing them, really, because you get a cottagecore video, you identify with it. It feels good to get something that you think belongs to. You're like, wow, the algorithm really knows me. But the algorithm kind of manufactured this in the first place, or circularly did with actual people emergently creating a new identity that's then easy for them to make money off of. And isn't it convenient that cottagecore clothing is one click away on the TikTok shop?
Isn't it convenient indeed? Well, there's a lot of people who talk about regulating algorithms or regulating these social media companies. Do you see any appetite, any danger? How do you think about those possibilities? I mean, TikTok is, I think, if I understand it correctly, it should be banned in the United States right now by law, or at least downloading of the app, even though the administration is kind of ignoring that law. How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, whatever's happening with TikTok, it clearly still is around. It's true that platforms are just allowed to do whatever they want. They have carte blanche. They have there's Section 230 of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which says that basically platforms are not liable for their users' speech, and also platforms can impose whatever regulations they want. So what that means is that they can just decide what speech they want on the platforms, not subject to government regulation. This doesn't count as free speech or not if they decide to censor something. So they often censor for commercial priorities. YouTube tries to have language that can be monetized, for example, and they'll demonetize creators. And as a result, creators tend to use more corporate-friendly, sanitized language. TikTok will censor, language that it doesn't like as well. So this is sort of a trend we see, that the platforms have control over the general speech, although I will say that people are very inventive with finding ways to express concepts. So it's again, this is not some Orwellian scenario. But the platforms do have an inordinate amount of power, and small platform tweaks can really change what content we're seeing and what messaging we're getting. In January of 2025, for example, Meta loosened a lot of content guidelines on Instagram and Facebook. They allowed for more AI content. And what that means is that since January, there's been way more racist AI slop on Instagram Reels than I had ever seen before in my entire time on social media. And it's because they simply tweaked some parameters because Donald Trump got elected and they had this MAGA rebrand. And that's now changing the actual content and messaging we're getting.
You say it's not Orwellian, but it sounds at least dystopian, right? I mean, Orwell had some specific ideas about censorship and thought control, but it doesn't sound great.
Yes, I don't think they're doing thought control. They're clearly representing a different version of reality, which may influence kind of our headspace and our thoughts and our consensus. But we are still able to think things, and we are still able to express things, which the idea in 1984 was that you can't even think and express these things.
Yeah, well, we have always been at war with Oceania. Adam Alexic is a linguist. He's across social media at The Etymology Nerd, and he's also the author of AlgoSpeak, How Social Media is Transforming the Future of Language. That's all the time we have for our program today. Coming up on Monday, a return visit to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. The head of the museum, as well as the director of acquisitions, have collaborated on a new giant format coffee table book, full color photographs. It looks at 100 artifacts from the museum's collection that tell the story of Abraham Lincoln, his times, and his place in American culture. There's a new exhibit that is a companion to the book. We'll take you through that and talk about the genesis of the project with the authors coming up Monday on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. You can find our show wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Just search for Illinois Public Media. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday. When I say I love you, honey.